Welcome to the Practical Enneagram. I'm Rez and I'm hosting this thing. I'm a coach and Enneagram practitioner based just outside of London in the UK. I've started this podcast as a way to continue to learn about the wisest applications of the Enneagram from those who are either developing or using them or both. Because I'm a coach, I'm especially interested in where the Enneagram and coaching collide and how to be effective in deploying the Enneagram in service of others' development. Episode 1 is with Dr. Beatrice Chestnut and Uranio Pies. If you don't know their names, Beatrice is a psychologist, business coach and global Enneagram thought leader. Uranio is an international teacher of the Enneagram and inner work, renowned for his innovative and deep approaches. Together, they founded the Chestnut Pies Enneagram Academy, and they work together leading inner work and professional courses, workshops and retreats. My first face-to-face or Zoom-to-Zoom encounter with them was on one of their workshops last year. Many of the Enneagram's wisdom teachers inspire me, and these two are right at the top of the list. I decided to interview them about how to do effective typing at the beginning of a coaching relationship. So if you're interested in learning how to do that, listen in. Bea and Uranio, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedules. How are you? How are you navigating COVID life?
Me?
Pretty well. Staying busy. It's weird to be alone for so much of the time, for such a long period of time.
Yeah.
But I live in San Francisco and I'm right next to Golden Gate Park. And so I get out a lot, and that really helps, just to walk and run outside and walk to get takeout food for meals is also spicing up life. But yeah, it's hard, but getting through.
Right. And I'm fine. You know, taking this time to be a bit closer to my family and to develop a little bit of my repressed self-preservation instinct by having routines and, you know, eating a little better and a few things like that, and not traveling as much. And I mean, as CP Enneagram Academy, we had to adapt. We did a lot of traveling, and during this time we couldn't do it, and we went online mostly. And looking forward to the next chapters. What about you, Rez?
Yeah, I'm doing quite well, and like it always makes me feel a little bit guilty to say that, but I am doing quite well. I'm obviously missing connection a little bit, like everyone else. But it's been a real opportunity for me to put some even more energy into my creative side, which I've been sort of nurturing to some degree for a few years, but even more so maybe in the last 12 months or so. So
sounds good.
Good.
And thanks for inviting us to your podcast, and congratulations.
No, thank you so much. No, I think I said to you at the end of the workshop I did with you last year, I found in you the teachers that I was craving and looking for last year. So of course, you were the top of my list, and I was surprised and delighted when you said that you would.
Yeah, it's our honor also.
So as you both know, today I want to talk about effective typing from a very particular perspective, and that is typing that's being carried out by coaches and therapists for the purposes of informing a developmental path. The reason for that emphasis is because my own experience taught me that integrating the Enneagram into coaching begins with rigorous typing. And it's not intended to be a criticism of my coaching school, which is very rigorous, but the Enneagram was incorporated as a lens with little to no instruction about typing, actually. Or I was taught to type in the process of assessing for quite a few other aspects of the client's sort of constellation, we call it. And that was to be done within an hour or an hour and a half. So what happened, even for me, who was someone that had studied the Enneagram quite a lot prior to going through that process, I developed this current way that was more, it was like a harried pharmacist. That was how I was. I was doing it quickly, and I was designing my programs based on that assessment. And what I was missing was the resources that I found when I got to your training last year. And now I'm much more like a humble scientist with my typing, and the medicines that I'm offering further down the line, or you know, at least after I've done that, I'm offering with more confidence and hopefully efficacy. Before we get to your method, can you say a little bit about how you both learned to type people and what led you to develop your own method?
I'll invite B to answer you first. But if I may just say that becoming humble after, you know, having been typing people is for us one of the signs of seniority, of being more experienced. So I appreciate hearing this from you.
Thank you.
Yes. So Uranio and I both got our main early Enneagram training through the Narrative Tradition School, the school started by David Daniels and Helen Palmer. And when we went through, they were still teaching quite a bit, most of the program. And so they have a week of typing training where you create your own typing script and you practice a little bit. And then part of the internship that is part of their certification is you do 12 typing interviews, 6 of which are recorded, and then you work on those with a coach. So that was a process that I went through. And after that, I did many, many typing interviews. I'm a psychotherapist. Of course, in my early days of being a psychotherapist, I didn't really talk about the Enneagram with my clients. So some of it was just sort of observing them and kind of holding very lightly a hypothesis about what type they might be. But over time, I did a lot of typing interviews, and then I became a coach in their program. So I also coached other people in learning to do that typing interview process. And so over time, I developed and refined my set of questions for my interview, hearing like how different types would answer. And so over time, I felt like I was able to improve my interview more and more, and through supporting other people and developing our own scripts and doing their own interviewing training, I was able to learn even more through that process about what kinds of things it's important to do, what kinds of things help be a more effective typer, let's say.
Yeah. In my case, I eventually started teaching that Palmer Daniels program in Brazil, Italy, Spain, Portugal. And I did that for quite a few years. And we would teach students how to type and then do a supervision, which B did a lot also. But the teaching part was really useful to learn, you know, we learn the most when we teach, they say. And also I many times did typing interviews before running workshops with senior leaders in organizations. So yeah, that's basically my experience.
At what point did you two begin to develop CP Enneagram, not CP Academy? I keep
CP Enneagram Academy.
CP Enneagram Academy method.
Well, we started working together in 2017 and kind of formally set up the Enneagram Academy in early 2018. And from the beginning, we were seeing ourselves as having two core courses for professionals, basically teaching therapists and coaches and counselors and spiritual directors and Enneagram teachers and leaders and HR professionals how to incorporate the Enneagram in their professional practice in a solid, effective way. And we saw, of course, a big part of that helping people understand how to help guide people to find their correct type, because that is a challenge. And it is, as you're saying, sort of the first important step of the learning process, of the self-development process, is really having a sound way of getting to what type you really are. Because of course, a lot of people get mistyped. It can be very easy to mistype yourself or have someone else mistype you. So it was always from the beginning our sense that one of our courses would be about assessment and typing. And so as part of developing that course, we developed a typing interview. And you know, we wanted to build on the good training we got in the narrative tradition school. We wanted to, you know, do something different, but also based on the good work that they do. And so what we decided is we'd save our students time of sort of the trial and error of developing their own script, interview script, even though, of course, there's value in that process. But we thought, well, we'll save people time and give them the benefit of our experience by giving them an interview script. And I think I would say we really wanted to that the typing process is the beginning of the self-development process. We wanted to get away from the idea that all you really need to do is take a test and get an answer, that it's not really that simple. Now, of course, you know, people use tests and we support the use of tests. However, we really support people using multiple methods and not just simply taking a test and then taking that as the final answer, but seeing rather the output of a test as one piece of data that is to be considered among other pieces of data. So it's sort of like a multi-pronged or a multi-dimensional approach.
So that's interesting, Bea. I hadn't appreciated the narrative Enneagram. So I was aware that they have their own typing training that they do, and they have the students develop the scripts. But yeah, you gave us the script, which I'm really personally very grateful for, especially as it has these clarifying elements to it. So it's not just the questions. There's also like the years of your experience that we're getting in that as well.
And eventually, Rez, we started emphasizing more a few aspects on Enneagram theory, especially, namely, subtypes, arrows, and levels of awareness. And we found a way to integrate those learnings in our method of typing. And also, we developed not only the interview script or list of questions, but also a flowchart to make things a bit easier for students. Maybe you could say what your experience with that is.
It's so great. Like the process is, it goes from being doing those round of nine questions to being quite an open exploratory process. And then it becomes like, no, we're going to really narrow in here what the possibilities are and exclude the potential for mistakes. Like if I were to Enneagram type that process, it becomes very six-ish in the best possible way. It's being very useful in my coaching practice.
You're glad you're using the method.
Yeah. So it's those nine typing commandments that I learned about on your course, which I love them. And I would like to paraphrase them and maybe offer them up for one of you, for both of you to expand on maybe one or two of them. So they are, number one, the more experienced you are, the more conservative you should be. Two and three, be humble, but be forthright too. So tell people if you're not convinced that they have their type wrong. Don't be too directive about it as well. Number four, understand subtypes. Number five, consider the client's level of awareness. There's a lot to say about that one. And number six, use tests, but don't rely on them. Number seven, practice using a specific set of questions. Eight, remember to ask follow-up questions, including examples. Nine, remember that typing with the Enneagram is complex.
I'm not sure if you said number three about maybe you can mention it.
I think I accidentally amalgamated two and three there. Two is be humble. So don't type people too quickly is what I get from that. Three is, but don't avoid or don't shy away from telling people if you think that you're not convinced about their type.
I like the way you paraphrased all of them. And it was a good summary. Thank you.
I do think those reflect our values. On the one hand, as an Enneagram guide, it's important not to think you know someone's type too quickly with too much certainty. Of course, when you're trying to help someone find their type, there's a natural anxiety about finding the right answer. And you know, they're coming to you as an authority. And what if you can't figure it out? And what if you don't know how to do it? And so I think sometimes what that natural worry causes, and it didn't me, so I know this from experience, is a rush to judgment. Like, I've got to figure out the answer so I can calm down, so I can ease my sense of uncertainty so that I can be the authority. And so what happens is, if you decide too quickly, then it's like a confirmation bias. Like if I say, oh, I think they're a six, then I start hearing all their answers through the lens of trying to prove my hypothesis that they're a six. So a big part of the art of typing is to suspend judgment until you allow yourself to ask as many questions as possible and you get the full picture. And of course, another thing is, I still do typing interviews. And one of the things I hear from people who come to me who've remained uncertain about their type is they at one point talked to a coach who said, oh, well, because you think this, you can't be this type, right? And it's almost like they get too definitive around questions that aren't really that determinative of a particular type. So someone will come to me and they'll say, like, my Enneagram coach said I couldn't be a two. Right. And in my interview, I end up thinking there are two. And oftentimes it was based on something that I don't think that was that central to being a two or not, you know, like whether you're patient or not. Well, some twos are patient and a lot of twos are impatient. And so that shouldn't be a determining factor. So I think it's important not to be too directive or too pushy or to think that you know their type before you do, or to get too certain too quickly. But I also think it's good to be the authority, to do your homework and to develop your skill at typing so that you can really provide some sound help. And so that you can, if someone thinks they're a type and you're not sure yet, you can kind of open up the space for exploration and continue asking the right questions and continue having a good process until you both feel confident, you and your client, that you've gotten to something that makes sense. Now, one of the things I emphasize about this, and this is what I would do when I was coaching people in typing process, is when you tell someone based on an interview what type you think they might be, and again, you always need to present it as a hypothesis, not a certainty, because that's the humility. You need to tie your hypothesis to the evidence of what the person said. And it needs to be a clear interpretation or reflection of what they said. So not sort of twisting it to fit your preferred hypothesis, but saying, well, you said this, and I think you're a four because fours tend to be like this. So I think you need to really make a case for whatever type you think they might be, always holding that hypothesis lightly until the person themselves has said, wow, yes, that really lands for me. That really sounds right.
Another thing I would like to add is that we teach our students in the path to be humble, to never nail down type, never say they're certain about anything, while still, you know, providing an opinion on the last part, the feedback, saying, based on what I've just heard from you, I think the most probable type for you is this one. And then this second and third hypothesis also, you say a little bit about them. Then there is a whole part of asking the client to validate that type. Of course, with the first reaction when you explain that during the interview, but mostly after the interview, after reading something, after giving it more thought. And with you as the practitioner remaining open to whatever feedback comes, which potentially can change your own mind. So staying humble if the person comes up with a different type that you thought the person could be. And if you don't agree with the later conclusion by the person, never say, I don't agree, period, or I'm right or you're wrong. So it's more like, I'm not yet convinced. Oh, this, can you please convince me or try to convince me and argue? So it's a, as B well explained, it's a balance between offering your authority and experience to the person's for the person's benefit and you know, listening from the person who should always be the ultimate decision maker and, you know, person saying what type they are.
I think this is so such a respectful way to handle the process. And I'm glad that you brought in there that the sort of guidance you gave us around giving the feedback at the end of the interview. Do not offer one type, offer a hypothesis and two types, and yeah, really check and get validation from the client.
Yeah, actually the narrative tradition already did that. I want to give them credit for that. But what I think we try to do is to really combine this authority that we as practitioners need to have with that humble approach, you staying open. And also doing a whole thing about the person validating it later. So connecting the typing interview to further steps along the path and having it very clear that the typing interview is just a beginning of a whole discovery, self-discovery process.
And I actually look forward, and I always save time at the end to have more of a conversation about what I'm hearing. So it's like, here's what I'm hearing. What do you think of that? And then I might ask a few more questions, but I even tell the person the last section of our interview will be you and I working together in collaboration. You know, you're the expert on you, you know, I'm hopefully the expert on the Enneagram, and we're finding how you fit into the system as part of this process of you coming to know yourself even better.
And behind what Bees just said is this principle of always asking questions and questions and questions and hearing from the person, you know, what the answers are. And the interview process itself is rich. You know, it invites the person to go inside and explore different aspects. Even regardless of the result, people benefit from it.
Completely agree, yeah. I'd like to actually just switch gears slightly, if I may, and talk about the vehicle of the tool itself, so the coach. And do you see, this is going to result in some reductive statements, I don't know, but do you see specific obstacles to typing effectively arising from type, basically, and or say heart center types or head center types and body center types? And can you speak to the gifts of those types as well in that process?
Rania, would you like to say something first?
Okay, yeah, I can start. As you know, Rez, there are 9 types, and we divide them in 3 groups. We call the triads. So 3 of the types, 8s, 9s, and 1s, are body types. And these types, in my view, tend to think in absolute ways, like black or white, and sometimes to come to a conclusion about type quite quickly, and taking the first answer to a question as a definite answer, sometimes without asking too many follow-up questions, or finding it a bit harder in general to question themselves about the conclusions they are getting. For type 9, this is a little bit different, but as I said, in my view, a little bit, not completely different. And so there is a tendency for these 3 types to just go too quickly to an answer. And sometimes, not always, to do a typing interview in a rushed way, especially 8s, and without, you know, being a bit more careful. There is a difference according to the dominant instinct and the subtypes within those types also, but this is a more general tendency. And also 8s, 9s, and 1s sometimes find it harder to just keep asking open questions that are not as concrete, that don't contextualize the content of the question somehow. We say that not asking not giving your own examples, but asking people to give their examples is an important key of success when doing interviews. And it's not very easy for these types to do so. Mm. Now, for hard types, and then we can comment on all of them. For hard types, what I see is that sometimes they focus too much on the relationship with the interviewee, or they can also, you know, develop emotional impressions about the interviewee that may, you know, unconsciously at times become even more relevant to the final opinion they would give than the logical process itself. Mm. It's not for all of the three types and the nine subtypes within the triad, but it's a general tendency still. And hard types can also, you know, fall, in my view, a bit more in that bias of liking or not liking the person they're talking to, in a way that sometimes they can think like, if I like this person, I want the person to be my type. Yeah. Or if I don't like the person, I really don't want them to be the same type I am. And then the head types can be too heady and too logical and too scientific in the process, and leave out not only a little bit of the rapport needed to do the interview, but also leave out a little bit of the intuition that you might have, or, you know, be only based on content itself and not as much in energy or other nonverbal aspects. Mm. And they may be a little cold in the interview when doing the interview, a little too technical. And, you know, I'm a mental type. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I learned over time is that some people who didn't like that approach would make the interview harder for me for emotional or instinctual reasons. And that is a blind spot, I think, one of the biases for head types. Mm. But I'm curious to hear B's answer.
And I noticed that Rez asked about gifts as well. So yeah. I'll try to focus on the bright side. And this is about the interviewer, right? Not the interviewee. Okay. Mm. So I agree with everything Uranio said. I do think that with certain people who are centered in a certain way, they can have these things. I think that there's also the level of type, you know. For instance, I think sometimes sixes can overthink it a bit or get a little worried or anxious about finding the right answer and overthink it or move to finding the type more quickly to end their uncertainty. I think sometimes, exactly as Uranio is saying, like rapport with the interviewer can be an issue for heart types. I do think that heart types can also tune in a good way to the emotional makeup of the person. Mm-hmm. So how emotional is this person? Am I feeling touched by what they're saying? Noticing, okay, are they crying a little bit during the interview and understanding what that means? Mm-hmm. So a little bit more emotional intuition. I think similarly, head types can have a more mental kind of intuition, a kind of reading the big picture, being kind of objective about how to analyze the data that they're getting in a way that can be useful. And I think for the body-based types, they can be really good at kind of getting a gut feeling and being very grounded in the interview. And so helping the person feel at ease because there's a kind of groundedness that they bring and a straightforwardness and a kind of authenticity understanding the person and the process of the interview.
I'm so glad I asked that question. That was fascinating, and I really recognize myself as a heart type in both sides. Yes. And actually the prioritization on rapport really can feel quite conflictual with the pace of a typing interview, where it needs to move quickly, doesn't it?
Yes. And of course, some you can sometimes tell something about what type the person is by how much they say.
Yeah. Or how much they don't say.
Right.
And so, yeah, like similar question, but how do you both ensure that you conduct your typing interviews? I don't know if you do them, Yumanio. I know B, you do them. But
I do them at times, as much anymore. Yeah. But I did like hundreds and hundreds of them over my life.
Probably more than enough. But how do you ensure that you're sort of in your free centers when you're doing those interviews?
That's a very good question. Thanks for asking that. We emphasize the importance of being present when doing the interview, which has to do with taking in information from the interviewee, not only from your head, but also, you know, what feelings the person generate, as B said. And while I totally agree with B that hard types find that easier and more natural, we all can do that if we develop that capacity, emotional resonance, I'd call it, to see how much the person is coming from the heart or not. And then the gut feeling and the instinct about, you know, even the way that the person answers to the questions, like not really needing to think much before answering, or the clarity, the capacity to make an option to say something and not say the other side of that, which is what mental types would usually do. Especially sixes. So being on the three centers really allow you to get those subtleties that ultimately will be the differential assessment that you'll be able to do in harder interviews, because at least one or two every 10 interviews will be harder for different reasons. Mm-hmm. So if you don't, also, you know, when we are doing a typing interview, we are usually introducing the person to this wonderful self-development system that the Enneagram is, and we need to do so by embodying the right position on how to take that in, which is inviting for presence at the same time that you think about your type, and being present only to eventually later on the path go beyond your personality.
As we're talking, I'm realizing, I think that doing a typing interview and even seeing doing typing interviews as a practice or something that you develop as a skill is actually a really good way of being in all three centers, because you do need to be kind of analyzing, critically analyzing, what is this person saying and how can I extract the information from what they're saying and start to understand or sort of organize that data so that I can sort of start feeling into what the right type is, but also how am I feeling this person? Am I liking them? And it's funny when Urania was saying heart types liking or disliking interviewees, I can't remember the last time I disliked an interviewee. Yeah. I always find something to like. So I'm inclined to like people. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a way that, like, how are they hitting me? What am I noticing about their emotional tone? How do they answer my questions about emotions? And then being really attuned to like all the energetic, physical, sensory kind of data, like how quickly do they answer my questions? How much do they say? Do they talk a lot or do they talk a little bit? Are they more straightforward? Are they more like telling me long stories? And how do they seem to react in different ways? So I think when you're picking up those different channels of data, it almost invites you or draws you into, I think, a practice of being in all three centers. Even though as we're talking, I'm realizing I could probably benefit myself from being even more conscious of those three centers being active when I'm doing an interview.
That's a lovely acknowledgement. I think probably that's never not going to be true for all of us, is it?
Yes.
To be able to turn up the present style. But I love that. I love that. Especially, I love the idea of being worked as I'm working as well.
Mm-hmm. We always get the client that we need the most for our own self-development, even in a typing interview.
In addition to your typing method, you're collaborating with a British psychometric specialist to launch a new test, the CPS E-type indicator. So why did you decide to put some energy into this and also the creating of reports?
Good question. So, you know, there are tests out there and we're aware of that. And we're also aware that a lot of the tests out there are not very accurate. And especially the free tests or the tests that don't include the subtypes or the tests that haven't been continually improved and refined. There just aren't that many tests, but people will take tests, right? There'll always be a desire to have that kind of data and to see what the test says. So we thought that it would be good for us to also do this as another kind of approach to helping people find their type. And we were friends with this, as you say, psychometric specialist, Fergus Sullivan in the UK. He's a great guy. And he told us all about the test he was developing. And one of the frustration I see a more sophisticated test like this. There's the test and then there's the report, right? There's the delivery vehicle of the results. I think there are some good tests out there that have reports that are sophisticated, but again, with Uranio and I having high standards for all Enneagram work, I think there is a way that we really wanted to create our own reports so that we could try to do the best job that we could to present that information to people and to bring people into the Enneagram. As we're saying, to almost have the result of the test be very specifically developed as the first stage of the development process. So it's not just you fill out a form, it spits out a number, and that's it. It's more that you take a test that is, you know, that is accurate, that has a high level of accuracy, and then you get a report that invites you into seeing the Enneagram as the sophisticated tool that it is for self-development. So both having a really good report that has really good information about type and subtype and different aspects of type that invites the person to really deepen their self-understanding just as a result of having taken the test.
Yes, and the work that Fergus Sullivan did is sophisticated also from a technological perspective. So this test is based in machine learning and it's adaptive, as we say it. It gets better and better with time. Fergus is really open to all the inputs that Bea and I have brought him, and a good partner for us when it comes to making it a better, more a little more aligned with our own Enneagram theory and understanding and the ways we work with the Enneagram also.
I'm excited to have your reports and for them to be out there. That will be good. When is it happening?
We're hoping to launch it in the next 3 to 6 months.
Oh yeah.
And hopefully March or April, but we'll see.
2021, because we're sure that your podcast will leave much longer than that.
Thank you. I hope so. And you'll announce it on Enneagram 2.0, I guess, when it's
absolutely
available. Yes. Yeah. And on our website, cpenneagram.com. I just want to say that when it comes to typing, Riz, we believe that the combination of a good test with a typing interview and an ongoing process of investigation. That is what a brilliant system like the Enneagram calls for. Mm-hmm. You know, these initiatives together make it, I believe they honor the depth and importance of the Enneagram system with a client.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that, the intention is for the test to be an adjunct to the typing method, not for it to be either or, it's both.
Yes. Yeah. Also because we are not a test, Enneagram test company. We mm-hmm. we have that as one of our tools, and mm-hmm. And like you, we see you doing good work, not only in typing, but in helping your clients further, mm-hmm. But starting being open to tests and the interview and the client's mm-hmm. self-observation. So this is our wish.
Thank you. What is there anything that you would highlight about effective typing that we haven't covered on this conversation?
I think that it's never enough to take someone's first answer. Mm. And you need to explore first what the person means with what they've just said. And there are different takes that people have. You need to see, you know, what is behind the first answer that the person has. Mm. And therefore, you need to have good follow-up questions, like explore the first answer that the client gives you with questions like, has it always been like this? Can you give me an example? What do you really mean about this? Or what exactly do you think is behind that? And mm-hmm. So on. So there are many different follow-up questions that you need to have. It's sometimes better to do very good follow-up questions mm-hmm. than to ask an additional one, you know, mm-hmm. an additional question of another theme.
Interesting. Yep.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I think so much is in the follow-up question. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, you know, if you ask someone what role fear has played in their life, mm-hmm. If they say, oh, it's played a significant role, you know, the next question I always ask is, what kinds of things make you feel afraid, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's going to be a really different answer if it's, say, a 6, versus someone who is the self-preservation dominant, or there's certain kinds of things heart types are afraid of. Some of them may have significant amount of fear. So that the follow-ups are really, really key. What's the degree? How long? You know, because sometimes people want to answer only from what's recently true as opposed to over time. So that's really, really important. I would say another thing is to be really aware of the potential sources of mistyping. Mm. And one of the things that we really emphasize that you've already named, but I think it bears repeating and even emphasizing even more, is the subtypes. Mm. You know, I think that's one of the things that makes our approach uniquely effective, is because not all people in the Enneagram world adhere to our approach to the subtypes, which comes from Claudio Naranjo's more modern view. And, you know, in these 27, you find options for types that aren't found in the 9 types alone. And so a lot of times when I do typing interviews, it's often someone who's been mistyped by someone else or hasn't been able to find their type. And sometimes it's the subtype that allows me to help the person get more clarity, because maybe they're a 7 that doesn't look like a 7, or a 3 that doesn't look like a 3, because they don't relate to recognition or competitiveness in the ways that they think they should if they're a 3. But I can talk about the subtypes and almost offer them more nuanced categories. You know, as you probably know, a lot of people will not find self-preservation 4s. They won't be able to accurately type them because they don't know what a self-preservation 4 is, what they look like and what their patterns are and how they answer and how they can look like other types. And then another thing I would say is really important to be aware of blind spots of the types, because when you're asking questions, sometimes that person you're interviewing isn't a reliable reporter about themselves, right? So like if you're asking a certain group of sixes about fear, some of them may say they're not really that afraid, right? And maybe they don't call it fear, or maybe they're a counterphobic six who's not so aware of fear as fear. And maybe it's a seven that isn't aware of the fact that they avoid pain. And so it's really important to be aware of when not to fully trust what someone says, but again, to investigate further, because there are certain things that are blind spots that sometimes in an interview, it can really sort of throw you off course, because you can start thinking, well, this person can't be this type because they're not identifying one of the fundamental pieces of that type. But if it's a blind spot, then it sort of makes sense.
And is this the sort of interviewee that prompted what you said earlier, Urania, about there being occasionally like two difficult typing interviews in 10? What results?
I think that's one case.
Yeah.
There are a few reasons why sometimes the typing interview is difficult. Mm. One is low level of awareness, but actually the other side of that is also true. Like people with higher level of awareness and who have changed quite a bit over time may find it more difficult for you to type them. You may find it difficult because they are not anymore as fixed in that personality, or they may see themselves in different types. But there are also other reasons. You know, sometimes the parent overlay or the arrows on the Enneagram, or what we sometimes call the energy mix of that someone is sort of mixed up with someone else's energy. Then that becomes a bit tricky to the person. And also cultural aspects, like where the person comes from and what that culture looks like, even on Enneagram terms. So there are many different things to consider. And also on regard to what B said, it's quite important to know how to adequately compare two or three types that you are in doubt about. So it's important for you to have the right questions to ask when you are in a doubt between two types. And these specific comparisons is something that we try to have our students get ready for and study hard, because there are, you know, many combinations, and you need to sort of understand those differences and be able to ask the right questions. But I think you raised another important point, which is the level of awareness. And it's quite important at times during interviews with people who have been doing inner work to ask how they used to be before they started to do that inner work, because that will probably be a bit more accurate about their types than if you don't ask that. It's not that they are not their types anymore. They have just become a bit more flexible within their types.
Thank you. Where can people learn more about your work?
At cpenneagram.com. That's becoming the place where we've been improving and adding to that website. So it has CP Online, which is our content platform. It's an online community where people can become a member and have access to hundreds of videos and audios. And we also have a blog on there, and we'll be doing new things with that. And then there's also the CP Enneagram Academy website, where we talk about our courses and other programs. And streamed courses. And we just did a panel series that we're proud of. So cpenneagram.com.
So much more I wish I could ask you. Can you come back maybe at some point, and so that we can have a whole conversation around the assessment factors that you map out, because those are very exciting as well to me as a coach.
Sure. Yes, I'd love to.
Yes. Good.
So that's it. I hope that you enjoyed the episode as much as I enjoyed interviewing Bian Uranio. If you did, I'd love it if you gave me a rating on the service you listened from. Next time, my interviewee is Mariana Mayer, an executive and life development coach who serves as faculty of Integrative Enneagram Solutions accreditation process. If you're interested in learning about me and my work, you can go to my site, artofwellbeing.com and thepracticalenneagram.com.